6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Malaysia's Prime Minister confirms a plane part found belongs to a missing jetliner. Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak confirmed that a part of the airplane wing found on Reunion Island last week in the Indian Ocean is that of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, which disappeared 17 months ago.
The burden and uncertainty faced by the families during this time has been unspeakable. It is my hope that this confirmation, however tragic and painful, will at least bring certainty to the families and loved ones of the 239 people on board MH370. They have our deepest sympathy and prayers.
Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott says the long search for the missing aircraft in the Indian Ocean will continue.
What we have found in the Western Indian Ocean does seem to indicate that the plane did come down more or less where we thought it did, and it suggests that for the first time we might be a little bit closer to solving this baffling mystery.
French experts are not yet ready to say for certain the flaperon found on the French territory is part of the vanished plane. The president of Ivory Coast, Alassane Ouattara, Wednesday submitted his name as a candidate for re-election in October. Mr. Ouattara, who won an election marred by violence, said he hopes the October 25th ballot will be calm and the results respected by all. Former President Laurent Gbagbo and his supporters refused to accept defeat in 2010. Post-election violence then left some 3,000 dead. Gbagbo is now in custody of the International Criminal Court at The Hague, awaiting trial for crimes against humanity. This is VOA News. President Obama presented a defense of the International Iran Nuclear Agreement on Wednesday, insisting it is a good deal for the whole world. Speaking at American University, he urged U.S. lawmakers reviewing the pact not to reject it when they vote on it next month.
Congressional rejection of this deal leaves any U.S. administration that is absolutely committed to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon with one option: another war in the Middle East. I say this not to be provocative. I am stating a fact. Without this deal, Iran will be in a position, however tough our rhetoric may be, to steadily advance its capabilities.
Mr. Obama says vigorous inspections and economic incentives will ensure Iran abides by the deal's terms. The U.S. Defense Department says U.S. forces in Turkey have carried out their first strike against Islamic State fighters in Syria. The Pentagon says the attack was carried out using an unmanned drone aircraft Wednesday. Troops loyal to deposed Yemeni President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, with help from a Saudi-led air campaign, have retaken much of the southern part of the country from Shia Houthi insurgents, including a provincial capital. Pro-government forces have retaken several southern villages, the Al-Anad Air Base, and the capital in recent days. Japan Thursday marked the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, with tens of thousands, led by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, gathering at the city's Peace Park Memorial to observe a moment of silence at the time the bomb exploded over the city's center. Mr. Abe said, as the only country attacked by nuclear weapons, we have a mission to create a world without nuclear arms. In Malaysia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the anniversary points to the importance of the nuclear deal with Iran.
Needless to say, it's a very, very powerful reminder of not just the impact of war in a lasting way on people, on countries, but it's also underscores the importance of the agreement we've reached with Iran to reduce the possibility of more nuclear weapons.
The death toll from the Hiroshima bombing is believed to have reached some 140,000 in the days and months that followed the August 6, 1945 attack. Meanwhile, Mr. Abe has expressed concern over allegations the U.S. spied on senior Japanese government and business officials. A government spokesman says U.S. Vice President Joe Biden apologized for the matter in a phone call with the Prime Minister. Some 12,000 Nigerian refugees are being repatriated from Cameroon after they fled violence by the militant group Boko Haram. Cameroon expelled hundreds last week as part of a new security measure intended to prevent Boko Haram suicide attacks, which have plagued the country. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, filling in for James Butte, who is on vacation this week. Today is Thursday, August 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union condemns ongoing unrest in Burundi.
I should say that the immediate reaction of the African Union is to actually express condolences to all those who have been killed and to the members of their various families, as well as the friends and the government and people of Burundi.
Jacob Eno Aben is a spokesman for the African Union in Addis Ababa. Also, Nigeria's military disables mines planted by Islamic terrorist group Boko Haram.
Yesterday, they were able to clear the road linking Yantake and Goza that leads up to Vita and other places, but specifically between Yantake and Goza, where they were able to detonate about five improvised explosive devices planted by the Boko Haram terrorists.
That's Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman, the acting director of Army Public Relations in Nigeria. Health workers scale up malaria prevention treatments in Burkina Faso and Niger. And a project in Ghana helps boost job placement for young people interested in the digital media. Those stories, plus Mark Uma's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union has called for restraint in Burundi following the murder of a leading member of the ruling CNDD-FDD party in the capital, Bujumbura. Kwame Harerimana was the president of the CNDD-FDD chapter in Kenyosha district. Officials say he was heading to his office on the back of a motorbike Wednesday when a crowd threw stones at him. Harerimana was then pulled from the motorcycle and shot. The murder is the third high-profile attack in 4 days as the crisis in Burundi deepens. In an interview with reporter Peter Cloti, Jacob Eno Aben, spokesman for the African Union, issued a very strong condemnation for what he called the barbaric acts going on in Burundi right now.
I should say that the immediate reaction of the African Union is to actually express condolences to all those who have been killed and to the members of their various families, as well as the friends and the government and people of Burundi. And secondly, to also wish speedy recovery to those who are suffering from injuries. It's a very strong condemnation of the sort of barbaric act that is going on in Burundi right now. The chairperson has called on the government, the ruling party, the parties in the opposition, as well as civil society organizations to really work together under the leadership of President Museveni, who is, as you know, is currently facilitating the mediation efforts under the auspices of the East African Community. And the African Union is continuously supporting all those initiatives and making sure that situation is stabilized and that Burundi can return to the path of peace and stability as well as its economic, socioeconomic development.
Some Burundians I spoke with seem to be not overly enthused about President Museveni's mediation effort. Some of them are saying it's too slow and appear not to be gathering any momentum to resolve the current crisis in the country, and they called on the AU and the East African Community to step up efforts to try to ensure this matter is resolved, because they fear that this escalation of violence could lead to the civil war that both the African Union and the EAC do not want to see.
I can tell you that the leaders are not sleeping. They're talking to one another back and forth. There are quite a few things that come to the public, but a lot of what is being done doesn't come to the public. And maybe it's thanks to these efforts that probably the situation is where we are. It could have been worse. Nobody is wishing for that. But we really should give peace a chance.
Jacob Eno Aben is the spokesman for the African Union. He spoke with reporter Peter Cloti from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. A spokesman for the Nigeria military says it has cleared the strategic road of Gwoza Yamteke in Borno State of explosives planted by Boko Haram militants. Colonel Sani Kakashika Usman says troops fighting the militants are determined to clear all roads in the country's northeast of improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. He talked about the goals of the operation with reporter Peter Cloti.
Our thrust, particularly that of 7th Division, as far as their mandate, apart from routing out the Boko Haram terrorists, is to also clear all roads that have been laden with mines by the Boko Haram terrorists. So yesterday they were able to clear the roads linking Yamteke and Gwoza that leads up to Bita and other places, but specifically between Yamteke and Gwoza, where they were able to detonate about five improvised explosive devices planted by the Boko Haram terrorists.
Well, we also heard that the army recovered some drilling machines and other cutting machines. What can you tell me about this?
Yes, you know, for quite some time, Boko Haram terrorists spilled over to the town of Dikwa, where they held sway. Unfortunately, the town, being big as it were, it was deserted by the inhabitants. So they converted the chemistry laboratory in one of the College of Agriculture into an improvised explosive device-making machine factory, in which, you know, after routing them out, we were able to discover quite a lot of things that they use in making IED, which comprise of chemicals, drilling machines, assorted weapons, including mortar guns, I mean, mortar artillery shells, rather, and so many other things, really. And, of course, abandoned vehicles that were mounted with anti-aircraft guns and stuff like that.
So, talking about the operation, is the Nigeria Air Force part of this move by bombarding them from the air in the Sambesi forest? And what about this rocket-propelled grenades that were found as well?
Yeah, you know, the fight against Boko Haram terrorists is a collective responsibility among the armed forces of the country. And in fact, all the segments of Nigerian society have keyed into. So basically, before any operation takes place, the Air Force plays a very significant role by bombarding the suspected Boko Haram terrorist locations, and then the troops move in. So it's a joint operation between the Nigerian Army and, of course, the Nigerian Air Force.
We are hearing reports that some Boko Haram representatives have contacted the government to negotiate. Is this as a result? Some Nigerians are saying this is as a result of the successes of the Army offensive against them. Do you have any reaction to that?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You know, the Nigerian Army and indeed the Nigerian military has been recording tremendous success in the fight against Boko Haram terrorists. In fact, we have reduced them to, insignificant number now. So I won't be surprised if they are making overtures, you know, to make peace with the Nigerian state.
That was Nigerian military spokesman Colonel Sani Kakashika Usman. He was speaking with reporter Peter Cloti. Malaria caused an estimated 627,000 deaths in 2012, according to the World Health Organization, and 90% of those deaths were in sub-Saharan Africa. Medical groups working in the region, such as the Alliance for International Medical Action, or ALIMA, are pushing for a scale-up of seasonal malaria chemo prevention treatments to reduce the death toll. The treatments, which are oral drugs that work to prevent malaria during the rainy season, can prevent up to 75% of simple malaria cases. Dr. Ali Watara is the group's deputy director of programming. He tells Ricky Shryock that in addition to areas of Burkina Faso and Niger, the alliance will start administering the drugs for a second year in Mali in coming weeks. They also hope to eventually increase activities in other regions.
The impact of this new strategy has reduced significantly, I will say 75%, the number of malaria in the area where we are working.
Could you be a little more specific when you say strategy? It's a malarial prevention medicine.
Yeah, this is a medicine, but we call it a prevention strategy because if you want to prevent malaria, you can use many strategies. There is a strategy where you can just sleep under the mosquito net. There is many. But this new strategy, this is a drug we are talking about, and this is an anti-malaria drug which you give to children. You just give them one dose in the month for at least 3 months. So this can prevent against malaria.
One dose could prevent them from getting malaria for how long?
Just 1 month. And then you renew it 4 weeks again. You give 3 days. You renew again 4 weeks. You know, during the year, you can give it 3 to 4 months.
So it lasts 1 month, and you give it 3 to 4 times a year, and that would be during the rainy season, once a month.
Yeah, that's correct.
How is this different from other anti-malarials, you know, other pills that people would take to prevent malaria? Why is this specifically different or new?
No, but this is new because this shows the real results. When I came last, say that the couple months from Mali, when I was discussing with my team, they were telling me that, look, at last year we used to have like many children in our hospitalization room. Since we initiated really the SMC, we realized that we have less children coming sick because most of the, one of the first causes of consultation in where we are working is malaria.
How much does it cost per dose per child?
$3 to $4 per child for the whole for 4 months.
Can you describe to me again a little bit the results that you saw?
We have started to use it last year in 3 countries, in Mali, Burkina Faso, and also in Niger. And the total number of children which we put under this drug was around 120,000.
And what kind of results did you see in these areas, for example? Do you have any numbers?
We saw like in Boussé, in Burkina Faso, the number of consultation was dropped by 75%.
This year, is it scaling up? Are you using it in more areas?
We need to use it in the area where we have been using last year. That means that's what we are doing this year. But what we are advocacy is really to push to use it in more area because you need to have a huge coverage. Because we know that malaria is one of the first killer, you know, for children under 5 in West Africa.
That was Dr. Ali Ouattara, Deputy Director of Programming for the Alliance for International Medical Action. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Dakar. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, and today is Thursday, August 6th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. In Ghana, a new initiative is set to provide employment opportunities for 1,000 Ghanaian youth in ICT-related services. The effort is called the Digital Youth Empowerment Project. It's being managed by the Media Foundation for West Africa in partnership with a telecommunications service provider, MTN Ghana. The target includes people between the ages of 18 and 30. The project's executive director, Sulemana Brame, says it's part of a broader scheme to provide greater internet freedom in West Africa. He explains the new model to reporter Joanna Manti in Accra.
First of all, we are looking at how can we empower young people who have ambitions, who have ideas, who have innovations, to be able to jumpstart certain projects they may have, to be able to develop applications that may be on and for one reason or the other has been stalled. How can we connect people who have already developed very great innovative applications and connecting them with industry, connecting them with potential users, connecting them with service providers, and so on and so forth.
So what type of people are we looking at? Are you looking at people with university degrees?
I would say that we are looking at people, first of all, who have interest in ICTs. whether they are high school graduates, whether they have diplomas, whether they even have basic school qualification, because sometimes with ICT, it doesn't really call for the ability to read and write. It's actually a passion. And someone who is interested in, okay, I want to learn how to code. I want to learn how I can put people together to develop a blog. And out of that, at some point, we monetize the blog and that becomes an avenue for job creation for young people.
Is this something that will lead them to develop their own jobs using the internet or just gaining skills to work for the private or public sector?
I think it's both. Those who are interested ultimately in developing their IT skills and they are not interested in starting something on their own, but having the necessary and relevant skills to be gainfully employed, either by organizations in the IT industry, public sector, private sector, or even creating a blog with colleagues and eventually monetizing that blog to be able to have some capital that would eventually lead them to developing something on their own.
How long will the training last? And are they going to be funded after finishing this project?
This project is going to be a continuous project. For now, the initial phase is a 2-year intervention. In terms of the training, we have, for example, regional digital youth expos, which are the mentoring and coaching sessions for young people. We are building what we call the Digital Youth Infobank, which is an online platform that is going to connect young people who are interested in innovations, ICT, digital stuff, to connect and share ideas, to learn about what others are doing, to tap into ideas that other people may have, and so on. Apart from that, we are looking at having what we call Digital Apps Fair, which will be an avenue for young people who have developed applications to come and showcase their applications, connect with industry, and so on. And then eventually we also have the Digital Entrepreneurship Startup Support, which will be a kind of startup support to support people to kickstart whatever ideas they may have in terms of becoming entrepreneurs.
That was Sulemana Brahme of the Digital Youth Empowerment Project. He was speaking with reporter Joanna Manti in Accra, Ghana. The cradle of mankind, Kenya's Rift Valley, is now being touted as the answer to all the country's energy problems. But most of the geothermal power is being drilled in natural parks, where Kenya tourists like to go, and many Maasai live. Observers say Kenya faces trade-offs as the need for more power runs afoul of traditional communities, local land rights, and the economics of tourism and conservation. From Nairobi, Hilary Hewler has the story.
The Rift Valley cuts a broad, magnificent swath through the heart of Kenya, its cliffs, lakes, and grasslands teeming with wildlife. National parks and protected areas are scattered along the length of the valley, and for some species, these havens are their last hope for survival. But these days, Kenya's human population is depending more heavily on the Rift Valley as well for electricity. The Olkaria Geothermal Power Plant produces 280 megawatts of geothermal power, enough to serve the needs of 500,000 homes. And there's talk of expanding it. Kenya plans to generate 5,000 geothermal megawatts by 2030. Tapping geothermal energy has already reduced power prices and promises to boost economic growth in a country where only 23% of the population have access to electricity. But Olkaria Geothermal Facility sits inside Hell's Gate, a national park, and as local conservationist Silas Wanjala explains, other parks are on the geothermal radar.
Previous geothermal surveys have indicated the entire Kenyan Rift Valley to be potential for geothermal power generation. It's a coincidence that these areas are also the only main areas which we have important biodiversity.
Geothermal is considered a relatively green and sustainable source of energy. But as the tarmacked roads and billowing steam vents of Olkaria demonstrate, it's difficult for any industry to avoid disrupting such a delicate ecosystem. Simon Thomset has worked with the birds of Hell's Gate for decades. He says for many rare species, the plant has been devastating.
Everybody recognized it was a fantastic location for raptors. It's full of cliffs, and so that means you've got eagles and vultures that nest on the cliffs. We lost the lammergeier in 1979. We lost the white-back vulture, and then we started to have a cascade of losses. And the single reason is because of the power generation in the park.
The vegetation of the park has also changed, says Wanjala, and large mammals like buffalo aren't as healthy as they used to be. Local guides say the development is hurting tourism and threatening their main source of income. Tour guide Robert Kiambati grew up near the park. He says he doesn't blame visitors for being disappointed.
The health gate that they knew in the past is what they see in the advertisement, but the real picture on the ground is quite different. Some tourists complain, and actually in several occasions we found some even asking for some refund because they didn't expect such development in the park. For them, it's more of an industrial park than a national park.
But Thomset says it's hard for conservationists to win in the face of Kenya's bottomless thirst for energy.
The Wildlife Act is obliged to protect our endangered species especially, but we also have the needs of the country to produce the power. So there's a huge area of conflict. One side has got to win, and now who's won is the energy side.
Kenya isn't the only African country facing the choice between conservation and keeping the lights on. And with Africa's population predicted to explode during the next few decades, so will its demand for electricity. It appears this conflict has only just begun. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Naivasha.
It's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Bill. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Hosts Mali picked Egypt 77-75 at the Africa Under 16 Basketball Championships in Bamako on Tuesday night. Algeria outplayed Equatorial Guinea 90-48. Nigeria edged Rwanda 72-68. Angola dismissed Tunisia 84-69. And South Africa beat Morocco 73-68. Today, Thursday, in quarterfinal action, Mali engage Morocco. Egypt play Tunisia. Algeria tackle South Africa. And Angola meet Nigeria. In football, African champions Mali, Guinea, Nigeria, and South Africa get to know their opponents in the preliminary round when the draws for the 2015 FIFA Under-17 World Cup takes place in Santiago, Chile today, Thursday. In netball, Malawi play South Africa as Uganda encounter tournament debutants Zambia at the start of the 2015 Netball World Cup in Sydney, Australia tomorrow, Friday. On Saturday, Uganda play Fiji, South Africa engage Singapore, Malawi tackle Sri Lanka, and Zambia challenge Wales. On Sunday, Malawi play Singapore, Zambia face Sri Lanka as Uganda encounter Wales. Finally, in volleyball, Tunisia play Iran in their opening match at the second World Men's Under-23 Volleyball Championships, starting in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, on the 24th of August. According to the draws in Dubai, Tunisia will also face Cuba, Mexico, Russia, and Turkey in the other Group B encounters. Meanwhile, Egypt is drawn in Group A with Argentina, Brazil, Italy, South Korea, and hosts United Arab Emirates. And that's it for the sports news. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Bill, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a wonderful day. That's it for this Thursday, August 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producers Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotie and Ricky Shryock, as well as sports editor Mark Uma, I'm William Eagle in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very great day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotie, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.